This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of the Geekscape Book Club. As always, I am Christian Blatt, and today we are speaking about Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale, Batman The Long Halloween, which for our visual audience, the book is disappearing into my virtual background, but that's okay. That is our topic today, and joined once again by Garrett Briones. Garrett, thank you for being here with us.
Of course. I love Halloween. I love when it's long, so I had to be here for it.
And this one's very long. And, of course, Eric Connor, identified on screen as Calendar Boy, which we very much appreciate. Now, Eric, I believe, like myself, you had not previously read this story. Is that correct?
Completely correct. And I'll say this has... We've done a lot of really cool books. This is as good as any of them, I thought. This was such a great read. So thank you for bringing this into my life.
Yeah, our fearless leader over at Geekscape, Jonathan London, was horrified that I had never read this book. And I always feel like there's times where I need to give simple explanations as to why I had never read anything before. One, this is a DC book, and I had read very few DC books in my active comic collecting days. Also, this came out in 1995, 1996, when I was drastically scaling back the comics that I wasn't even reading Spider-Man at this point. I was really just reading X-Men books, and it was more out of a sense of loyalty. But Garrett, you, of course, had read this before, correct?
Yes, I read it for the first time last year. That was my, it was a big blind spot, and I thought I had to finally fill that one.
Well, good for you that you did, because obviously it's, I had wanted to do this last year, but you know, our first Geekscape book club was Batman Year One, and I really thought we shouldn't dip into a similar style book, and obviously they're very different. However, they do both cover the early part of Batman's career, you know, and I think it was reading a little bit about it is this is kind of considered canon that replaces a lot of Batman Year Two, at least by some people's esteem. I don't think that's official. They just feel like it's more like that. And, you know, just reading the book and, you can see that Christopher Nolan pulled some inspiration from this, especially featuring of Harvey Dent and Matt Reeves also for The Batman. I think the feel for this is very similar to that. Obviously, the adversaries and all that is completely different. So a lot of Batman sort of content and some of it, it's just the visuals and some of the looks, I think were very much shaped by this. When you first read it last year, Garrett, what struck you the most about Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale's Batman The Long Halloween?
So for me, I think the thing I've always loved about Batman is in a similar way to Daredevil over at Marvel. He is so many different things for so many different people. He's the world's greatest detective. He's a ninja. He is, just a brawling crime fighter, Cape Crusader. He's all these different things. But my favorite cut of Batman is Detective Batman. That's what I always gravitate to. And what I do like about it is similar to, it does really feel like a sequel in some ways to Year One. And I like that it is, you know, Batman isn't super far in his career, but he's far enough that he has a rogues gallery. And I just love that it's as much about Batman and Gordon, and it's really an origin story, a long version of how Harvey Dent falls. It's not just the scene in the courtroom. It's everything leading up to it. And I love that it is the story of these three men that band together and say, we're gonna do this no matter what. And by the end of it, one of them, the person that they wanted to push out there as like, this is the guy that's going to save the city, is ultimately the one that succumbs to the darkness to try and beat the darkness.
Right. The idea that the only way to, destroy the darkness is really to be at the center of it. You know, you really have to take it in, and, you know, you can't just shine a light on it. That's not really going to do anything. Eric, I know that, like me, this week was when you read this for the first time. And what sort of expectations did you have going in? You know, Eric was, you were on our first show. You read year one with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I didn't want to cast aspersions and confuse Michael Shirley. People would be very upset if I did that. But
I mean, we do share a barber and a rabbi.
Obviously.
So I can understand the confusion. When I had ordered this, and I go to my Kindle and I realize I had ordered this already, like before, I don't know when. So clearly it was on my radar for I don't know how long. And yet somehow it's one I never got around to reading. And it is incredible how you could sort of see the fingerprints of this content. Like you were mentioning, you know, Matt Reeves' Batman, Chris Nolan's Batman. But then also you see the fingerprints of Tim Burton's work on this. You see even the Batman animated show, which...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, for so many of us around, you know, Christian, my age, like Kevin Conroy is still in our head the voice of Batman and probably will always be, you know. And so like some of the Joker stuff felt very much like if you ever saw the Christmas episode where Joker basically kidnaps everyone and puts on his own show. Like there was like kind of references to that, too. So... I mean, considering it had obviously an impact, you know, what really struck me at the center of it was really emotional. Like, I completely agree, Garrett, that the detective part of Batman has gotten a little bit of short shrift over the years with the films. Maybe this last one that Reeves did a bit more than the others. But this was a really good murder mystery, a detective story, and then a drama. Some of the chapters about Mother's Day and Father's Day, I will admit, kind of stuck with me. I actually had the feels for Batman there. I could connect with it in ways that definitely surprised me when I was reading a graphic novel. By the way, this sound effect, for those who can see it, what is that sound, gentlemen?
So for our audio audience, yes. There's a panel where you can see Batman. And he's upside down and he's like, it's basically that.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's Y. And for those who can't see it, YNGGGNN.
Yeah. So, well, that at the end is really the accentuation. Yeah. And I think that, it's interesting because, you know, I should also make the point of, not my favorite iteration of Bat mythos. Gotham, the TV series, is very heavily influenced by this style. That was sort of one of the things that I meant to say at the top. And they had a season where they pulled from elements from this. But you know, that focus on Jim Gordon, that's a much younger Jim Gordon. That's, yeah. You know, he's not even a captain at that point. But the idea of so much focus, and I think that was one of the most fascinating things about year one, was, you know, just dealing with his private life, which we've seen subsequently in other media, you know, so I can imagine, you know, getting this level of insight, you know, getting the backstory to Harvey Dent, Harvey Two-Face. You know, I think that, it's great too, because I don't know, when you were talking about ordering it on your Kindle and it showing up, Eric, I thought you were going to say, and I was like, oh, and it was like 500 pages, you know, because it's 13 books. It's actually, yep. I think 400. It's almost 400 pages. So it was a 13 issue because it's the long Halloween. It's a whole year. Right. And, you know, some of the, you know, there were holiday themed issues of the original series, which are, reprinted in at least the version, the collection that I got. And it's sort of great to see, you know, you can kind of have that fun, but it's over such a long period of time. It's hard to imagine, you know, stories like that stretching out over a long time, you know, because even like one of the more seminal stories I refer to a lot would be Spider-Man's Kraven's Last Hunt, which was 6 parts, but it was over 2 months because it ran through all 3 Spider-Man books, you know, so you didn't have to wait as long. You just had to wait a few weeks for the next part. It's in an age where people are used to binging shows. And the idea where you watch a show on a platform that only does it weekly, you know, Eric and I do a Loki after show here on Geekscape. And the idea of like, all right, well, we'll see what happens next week. Instead of like, oh, I just stayed up 2 more hours, you know, in the middle of the night and finished it. You know, the idea of more than a year to finish the story. And, you know, I could imagine it was fun at that time. You know, the online communities existed. But, you know, if you were lingering around your local comic book shop talking about, like, you know, 4 or 5 months in, so who's holiday, you know? And it's I'm glad for my sake I was able to read it in one collection, you know, that I didn't have to wait that long.
Yeah.
But it's always interesting to think about those things. What did you think, Garrett, specifically? Let's stay on Jim Gordon for a moment. You know, I think that year one is definitely, there's more struggles within Gordon, you know, his home life, his professional life. At this point, I think he's married to, one, his marriage, two, married to the job of, like, somebody has to stand up for Gotham City, and it's me, you know? And so I think, you know, he's really more locked in than he is perhaps in year one. But what do you think about Jim Gordon in this story?
Oh, I love it. I always love Jimbo. What I really like in as you said, it really does kind of play off how things were presented in year one, is I like that all three of our Trinity that we're following in this book, they all kind of have different relationships at home. You have Gordon, who is, he's trying to find that work-life balance. And by the end, we see that there is still love with he and his wife, that he's fully committed to her more than he is the job. And then you have someone like Bruce who goes home to Alfred, but he can't quite figure out his relationship with Selina. The entire book, they keep going back and forth, both as Batman and Catwoman, also as, you know, Selina Kyle and Bruce Wayne. And then you have Harvey, who he just completely kind of neglects his wife, aside from like a few little moments, but he ultimately can't find that balance. And so that's what I like, that ultimately we got to see 3 versions of it. But honestly, Gordon is probably the person who has his crap together the most of the 3, which coming off of year one, you maybe don't expect. But I love that, you know, Jim's got it all figured out in a way.
Right. Well, and I think too, it's like the marriage seems like new enough.
Yeah.
It's a baby. So there's a sense of maybe his wife here a little more patient than she might be in 5 years, but also he's still on the flip side, maybe a little bit more in the marriage, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, his balance is feels like I agree with you here. It's a little bit more even here. What's interesting too, so you're talking about the sort of the 3 shades of these men and how their various lives sort of eat at each other. So you have Harvey Dent, whose wife like idolizes him. Like Barbara was basically, you know, understanding, but you could tell she wasn't necessarily it wasn't going to be limitless, her understanding. And maybe it's because we do know that marriage will run into trouble down the road. So that might be adding to the read or my own read of it. But meanwhile, you had Dent's wife, which, you know, has a great payoff later. The idea that she just, the ground he walks up, she worships him and is just like the most, you know, dutiful sort of wifey wife, you know, imaginable. Yeah. She seemed to look past all the sort of things and problems. And then meanwhile, you got Bruce. There is one frame of Selena who's basically saying, hey, we're going to hang out tonight. And the panel is like, he says no. And I'm like, okay, dude, what is wrong with you? Like, it is the most sexy I've seen Selena Kyle, I think, in any Batman comic book. And he's like, nah, I got to go home and, you know, stare at the wall. and I'm like, yeah, I'm like, dude, come on. And but you see, right, the push and pull within him where he doesn't even know how to commit to anyone at all.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the three of them together is what gives this story such a surprising dramatic heart at the center of it, and how they can't find a way to balance it all. So it's like the long Halloween of their own lives, just ongoing, trying to figure this stuff out.
You know, the interesting thing that as we were reading it, you know, we're talking specifically about Harvey Dent and his wife. As I'm reading that, I was just thinking, you know, I unexpectedly it reminded me of, you know, another literary figure that perhaps was not a connection I was expecting to make. You know, there's the idea of like we'll start a family, we'll have kids when we're ready. And, you know, you're just reading it and it's so sad. And I was not expecting to be transported to, of course, Muppet Christmas Carol with the idea of the older Ebenezer Scrooge being reminded like, oh, yeah, yeah, that Belle girl, boy, she was perfect. All she really wanted was to get married. And I was like, yeah, 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 I just got to, you know, save some more money. He's like, oh, man, I just got to kill some more crazy, you know, supervillains, not even supervillains, but, you know, just the weirdos in Gotham City. And don't worry, I'm going to put them away. And, you know, it's very sad. And it's a fascinating turn as it goes along. And it's tough when a book is 25 or more years old to say that, you know, do we talk about spoilers or not? But there's just a tremendous reveal with his wife, you know, with Mrs. Dent. What was Gilda. Her first name? Gilda. Thank you. I was just like, I knew it didn't quite fit, you know. It was just like, oh, Gilda.
Was anyone named Gilda 25 years ago?
Gilda Radner had passed. Yeah. Right. So I don't know. Every Gilda. Once in a while you get that. But one of the things I was sort of touching on earlier was the idea that we get so many characters from the Batman mythos. You get Solomon Grundy. Honestly, he doesn't not need to show up in the story at all, but it's very cool to get him. And I mean, did you guys both read this the same way where for this iteration, he had not met Joker before? Did you take it that way as well? Or maybe, you know, it was like he knew of him. It was sort of like talking about the Joker in a way, like, oh, I hear about this, you know, sort of at the end of Batman Begins, you know, where he's like, oh, these cards were left around. I'll look into this. You know, it was almost more like, oh, I've heard of this Joker. They didn't really seem to know each other. Was that just me projecting? What do you think, Eric?
Oh, you said Eric or Garrett.
I said Eric, but okay, I didn't realize.
Hit that C hard.
I'm gonna have to switch the last
hit real hard. It's funny now that you say it, like, okay, that actually really makes sense. I don't think I was reading some of the sort of an additional material afterwards. I kind of wanted to go into it a little bit blind. And so afterwards seeing this idea, it was like kind of like a Batman year two. And then when I read that, I'm like, okay, that makes sense, because it didn't really strike me one way or the other. It just because Joker's role in this was so small and kind of almost like off in its own little corner. So what Batman knew of him, I didn't really think about, because Batman was so just not even focused on him. I think you probably could make a good argument that, yeah, they haven't really actually dealt with each other yet. But it's kind of a nice sense of like, you know, they're going to enter each other's orbits very soon.
Yeah. I mean, it is sort of it's an interesting moment in their dynamic, because in the context of this story, I mean, Poison Ivy has a greater impact on the story than Joker does. You know, Joker is one of many more annoyances than anything. What do you think, Garrett, of Joker in this book?
I kind of take it in the sense that they have had some clashes, but maybe they haven't had that defining clash. You know, going off of the end of year one, there is that sort of tease that there's a guy out there named the Joker. I kind of think it's like they've bumped a few times, but they haven't really defined that rivalry. But I like that the Joker's used in the story, but I love that it is just, he's used for two holidays, and then you don't see him until the end when all the bad guys, you know, when Dent teams all the bad guys up, which I will say, not a criticism, but Jeff Loeb, he also wrote Batman Hush. He kind of reuses the ideas of a big mystery that features every Batman villain, and also there's a plot point where Poison Ivy controls someone whose name ends with man for a few issues. That's a little crutch that he falls back on that I realized reading this that happens later. Just a little aside.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes if it ain't broke, you're not going to fix it, but I know what you're saying. Yeah, and it was interesting, you know, because Scarecrow is fairly, you know, easily pushed aside in the story. And I mean, it is interesting because obviously the underworld part of Gotham City figures into the even the Tim Burton movies, but it wasn't the central focus. And I mean, if you have to isolate, you know, if you're only using a sentence to summarize Long Halloween, you have to talk about how it deals with the, you know, the crime families, you know, and, you know, the family looking to muscle in from Chicago, you know. And I always love the distinction that Chicago, New York, Gotham, Metropolis are all separate places, you know, because I think as someone who didn't really read DC Comics, I just always felt like, you know, the Gotham was New York and Metropolis was Chicago, but it's not the case. And if you follow the Snyderverse, they're apparently across the bay from each other, you know? So it only just makes it more confusing as to where these places are, you know, but and then there's scenes that are, they're obviously, I mean, they're right out of, you know, the Godfather, they're right out of, you know, numerous Scorsese movies. And I think it's more homage, you know, I don't think it's like, oh, this worked in that movie, we're going to use it here. You know, I don't think major things, it felt derivative, but what did you think, Eric, of some of the nods in there? And I mean, some scenes that are, you know, several pages long where there's no costume characters. There's no costume characters in their secret identities. You know, these are really, you're like reading, you know, an artistic rendering of basically a, you know, a mob family storyline.
When I think they set the table pretty nicely for then what Dark Knight did, because, I mean, by the way, they actually do have a direct reference to The Godfather. Try the veal, it's the best of the city.
And there was something about a cannoli as well.
Those
were two moments. Yeah,
but I think too, you know, to their credit, it wasn't just like kind of like geeky fandom for The Godfather or for, you know, kind of more generic kind of mobsters. Like, you know, I thought the family dynamic was actually really interesting. You know, this idea of these various like kids, you know, of these very powerful people, and who are they? And how they're trying to make their kind of own way, and even like having a wedding early on in this thing, right? I mean, that harkens back right there. He does. Come on, Vernon, have the veal. It's the best in the city. And in fact, the next panel, which I don't think I sent you, Christian, was a like a medium wide exterior, like image of a car outside a restaurant that was almost visually identical to one of the shots in that sequence in The Godfather. But I think the family dynamics is really what kind of stuck out most, was, you know, this sense of like people are losing their loved ones and like feeling it. Like, so even though it is, you know, almost everyone who shed a tear also shed some blood. But the truth is, like, you feel for them. You understand their pain, and these two families that maybe would have had a chance to actually become like a super group, but in essence, all this is tearing them apart. And I think they were very smart in how they grounded it in, you know, the very basic elements of family, as opposed to trying to go kind of like all geeky with the crime syndicate. Like the actual crime part of it, weirdly enough, it's kind of small. It's a bit off panel, I guess I'd put it. You know, you don't necessarily see so much the crime dealings, but you see the consequences of what they do.
Yeah, what did you think of the family dynamic, Garrett, in terms of, you know, just the, you know, look, when you're telling a story over 13 issues, you actually have plenty of time in which to try and capture that. You know, what did you think of that as we saw it, Garrett?
What I really like is that in a lot of ways, the Falcone family is, you know, they're running Gotham. And I like that this story really kind of is like the last days of the mob having the grasp on Gotham City. Carmine is called the Roman and Salvatore Moroni is called the Boss. Like they have these little nicknames, but now they're starting to lose their foothold to people like the Joker, the Mad Hatter. Like these super criminals are starting to push and Batman being around as well, starting to push this old world mentality of what a crime boss is. They're pushing them out and it's like they're going extinct essentially. And I like that it is the fall of the last family that is holding this all together. And that even, you know, it's not super really kind of said in this story, but they very much hint at it that Selina Kyle is the daughter of Carmine Falcone. And even she is, again, she's part of this new breed of criminal. And by the end of the story, she's really, you know, besides someone that is revealed to be alive, she's really the last connection to this crime family that is slowly crumbling from the inside and losing their grasp on Gotham City.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's, as I referenced, you know, that there's a lot of this that you'll see in Gotham. And I mean, dealing with the actual crime families was a big part, especially in the early seasons, but they immediately got Penguin into it, you know, and right. I am particularly critical of that show because they loved the actor who played Penguin so much, who I think was great, that they put Penguin in literally every single episode of the show. And I was like, boy, it would be better if, I don't know, out of a 22 episode season, he was in like 10 or 15, you know, it was just like, you don't have to find a way to get him in there every week. And that was one of the things that I didn't love about it, but you know, and I think, I didn't even think of it until you said it, that this really is the point where crime was run by just, you know, regular people, nobody wearing, well, you know, fancy outfits or makeup or named after birds or clowns or things. What were you going to say, Eric?
Yeah, when also, too, like one of the subplots is like they're actually trying to get tied up with the banks. So it's no longer about just like how can they launder their money, you know, through all sorts of nefarious schemes, but they're actually, in some ways, when you get connected with a legitimate bank, that means you're legitimate. And you know, the how much money they burned, by the way, I thought if anything, I was hoping that would pay off a little bit more, because it is a moment. I mean, Dark Knight famously has that too, but I was like, wow, like they burned a lot of money. Then they didn't really talk about that very much, but that idea of becoming legit, I think, Christian, we might have talked about this scene in a different episode, but this great moment in The Sopranos when they're trying to shake down a Starbucks that moves to the neighborhood. And it's not called Starbucks, but, you know, coffee chain. And Garrett, I don't know if you saw this, but the guys show up and like, yeah, we're here with the Neighborhood Protection Watch. And so in essence, they're just trying to shake him down for protection money. And the store manager's like, I can't do that. I can't give you a nickel. They count every bean in corporate. Yeah. And even if you do something to me, then they'll bring in someone else and it's going to be the same story. And the guys come out and they're lamenting, there's no business anymore for the little guy. And so you're right, Garrett. It's like, it is like that swan song. And this came out, I'm sorry, it was middle of the 90s.
It's 95 into 96. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, even like think like Vegas around that time was totally became what it is now, like this sort of very legitimate, you know, corporations run by the banks. You know, by the mid 90s, it was the sort of gangster foothold there was gone, long gone, in fact. So, yeah, there's not much room for the little guy anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think that becomes an interesting thing about, you know, Batman. You know, he's really the Batman still in a lot of ways. You know, it's, you know, Gotham City at this point, it's, I don't know. I feel like at this point that the story happens, you could live in Gotham City and just somehow, you know, you don't read the papers or whatever. You don't actually know about the Batman, you know, whereas like a lot of times when we see him in the movies, like everybody knows, you know, what he is. And it, you know, it's further along than year one, but it's so interesting that he's not as well established, you know. And I like the scene where he goes to the bar where he's like, yeah, I'm here during the day. Usually he doesn't use the word shtick, but he's like, yeah, usually my shtick plays better at night. And I'm like, yeah, I could see it. It's like, oh, look, Adam West just walked in here. You know, it's like I can see everything about him. He's not hiding in the shadows, you know. And I think that there's definitely a lot of fun things that they deal with. I think that, you know, because it was this serialized, drawn out story that was conceived over 13 parts, it has a good degree of really mystery and suspense from chapter to chapter, issue to issue, in terms of what it is. Did either of you guys feel like you had an idea who Holiday was? And they were always, even when Calendar Man would say, well, he is very lucky for her, that, you know what I mean? Like, even Calendar Man was just, well, was right, actually. Calendar Man seemed to know that there were two of them, actually, you know. But I'll ask you first, Garrett, you know, did you know going into this, like, had you had like the ending sort of figured out from something else, or did you actually not know who Holiday was when you started reading?
No, when I went in, I had no idea. All I knew going in was that it was heavily pulled from, and I knew that Calendar Man featured heavily in it. You know, I mostly knew Calendar Man from the Batman Arkham game series. And so that was really I didn't know. I was very much surprised, especially with the, you know, they present somebody and then there's a switch. And then even at the end, when we're just kind of told all the details in, you know, thought bubbles, basically, there's also a third person that is put forth, that maybe it was actually three people and that one person wasn't doing it the whole time and someone else stepped in. So I had no idea.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of misdirects and redirects all the way through to the end. You know, I think that that's usually, you know, when you have the feeling that the third party is definitely getting away with it, you know, because the second party made sure, you know, and some you've seen that in other things. What did you think, Eric, as you were going through? Did you have like a Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia board where you were putting all your theories as to who Holiday was and following all the strings trying to figure it out?
Most of that energy is right now dedicated to trying to figure out what's in Loki sauce. So yeah, I don't know if I have much bandwidth for anything else. I have to admit, when I read mystery stories, detective stories, when I watch the films, I don't necessarily sit there and actively try and figure out who did it. I will admit, like, I know some people are sitting there, even my younger son, you know, will come in and more times than not, if we're watching something like that, he kind of figures it out fast, which means he's either going to be a great detective or worse, potentially a fabulous criminal. I really would. I love that image. Would
leave it up there,
Charlie,
for a little while.
For those not seeing it, Charlie doing his Charlie thing, with papers everywhere and his eyes bugging out wildly. Yeah.
There's just some memes live on for a reason. And I'm sorry, finish your thought, Eric.
Oh yeah, no, I was suspecting it was a female, but It did seem like they leaned a little hard into the aunt and the daughter. So we're talking, was it Carla and Sofia Gigante, or, you know, who, by the way, I love those characters so much that part of me kind of wanted them to be it. But I would have been off by many miles had I actually guessed. So it's good. I don't have that Charlie in me.
Now there's an animated film of this, which if I had tackled this appropriately, I would have watched before this instead of finish reading it this afternoon. So I'd be intrigued to see how it translates, because it would then beg the question. They were talking about elements of this. I don't think it translates well into a movie, because like, you would have to skip holidays, and that's sort of the whole point, is it's over a long time. I think it would very much work as like a 13-part miniseries. Well, on HBO Max, I assume, is where it would go, but obviously Batman really gets saved for the big screen, because even we've talked about Gotham, he's not Batman in that. It's like about Gotham before Batman, even though they try to bring a lot of Batman in, because it's like the Krypton show. It's like, what if you get Superman without Superman? Well, this is Batman without Batman. So it doesn't always work. I think that's why stories like this in Year One are so interesting. But I wouldn't want to see that, like, Matt Reeves' like third movie is Long Halloween, because I'm just like, well, the last one was 3 hours, so well, this would be seven. I can't even imagine telling the story in that way.
Christian, did you get? No, I was just going to ask you. Did you guess, were you trying to guess?
I got convinced in the middle of it that it was Harvey Dent, because Batman was so sure, and it's one of the last few issues. Gordon's like, you knew that, didn't you? Why didn't you tell me anything? And he's just like, I'm hoping I'm wrong, So it started to seem that way. And it would be great to, not have had multiple instances in my life where I know that Harvey Dent becomes Two-Face, because if you can believe in Harvey Dent as like, oh, this is the DA who actually is going to clean up Gotham City, and there's no notion of him going astray at any point for any reason, whatever's thrown in his face, whatever, coins he gets into his possession, it would probably be harder to believe. But knowing where he's going, I think, sort of clouded it. And anybody who is taking this in after the fact or in the live chat now, let us know if you read this and you had thoughts. If you haven't read this, we're doing our best to not spoil it for you. I would definitely encourage it. I think anybody who listened to our first show and did read Year One, this would be a great follow up for it. Mm-hmm. I've not read Year Two, and I believe there was also a Year Three. I haven't read any of that stuff. I've not read a lot of Batman. I liked the recent series they did, which was called Batman 1989, which like continued the Tim Burton verse. If it had stayed like that before becoming the Schumacher verse, as it were, and but in terms of Batman stories, when I was a kid, the X-Men had been around only 25 years. I felt like I could wrap my head around it. But when I was a kid, Batman had already been around for 50 years. Yeah, it was just that simple, And it's like, oh, where do I start? But I'm very glad to, have this show as an excuse to, the whole concept of the show is to read stuff like this. We talked about Catwoman a little bit earlier. Or as Christopher Walken refers to her, Catwoman. We talk about Catwoman in this. And, Eric, you said something that I was thinking about when you said it. There was the idea that, she's presented in this way where she's, never come off as sexier as Catwoman. And I was thinking, it's like she's, Julie Newmar, Lee Merriweather, and Eartha Kitt, like all like exponentially somehow they packed everything about each of them into
the best
one.
Of each of them.
The best of each of them. And, look, those are my cat women. All right. If somebody's got Michelle Pfeiffer, man. And Zoe Kravitz was actually fantastic. I'm a bit critical of the Matt Reeves movie, but I thought that casting was actually great. I thought she was phenomenal in it. I think that, she does show up a lot, and I love when it's not Bruce, Batman asks her, like, why are you always showing up every time I get near him? And it's like, well, why are you here? You know, like, why are you showing up so often? Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm just here when you are, you know. What do you think, Garrett, about Catwoman in this? You know, I mean, she does show up a lot of times, but each appearance is pretty short, even as Selina Kyle.
Yeah, I really enjoy it because, you know, you get to see her, you know, as Selina Kyle. She's trying to, you know, maybe pursue something with Bruce, but obviously he's too entrenched in what's going on with Holiday. So then even when she's, you know, as Catwoman, it's almost like you can tell she wants to get involved in this situation, and she doesn't really, you know, she saves Bruce from Poison Ivy. She kind of interjects. That's really the only time she does something that's not related to Carmine. And yeah, I like that the story doesn't straight up just tell you that she believes that Carmine is her father, she has her own push and pull in this whole story of, do I get involved? Do I stay out of it? Am I pursuing Bruce Wayne? Why am I pursuing Bruce Wayne if that's the case? She's kind of trying to figure out, like I was saying, how the old crime is out and the new crime is there. She's kind of stuck in between because she is a costumed criminal, but she is also maybe related to this family that runs the city. And by the end of it, she's kind of the last person that's related to it. And so she's kind of like caught in between the new Gotham and the old Gotham that are kind of warring against each other in this story. Christian, you're muted.
Oh, I think you're muted. What Christian meant to say was...
No. But for our visual audience, this is a panel that has Catwoman and Batman. And Eric, you actually sent this panel. So that's why I think we'll start there, and then your thoughts on Catwoman. Yeah.
So this is one of their many, I don't even know if in most cases you call it fights, right? Because it's a fair amount of hugging. With some.
Yeah, it's like sparring, you know, the Fox Daredevil movie, basically. They don't do Daredevil and Elektra don't fight, really, you know.
I'm going to go real old school on you here. When Mike Tyson fought James Bonecrusher Smith, and all he did was tie him up the whole fight, so he didn't actually have a chance at knocking him out.
Yeah.
And so this line here, curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought her back. It did remind me of some of those great exchanges between Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Keaton in Batman Returns, which I will always defend. I think Batman Returns was a better film than Batman from 1989, and I guess I'll fight people on that, but I would hug them closely.
I wish I had that drop of Homer Simpson of "Ooh, hot take," because I would definitely hit it right now. But I don't have those kind of drops.
The sentiment is felt. I think we get it. And I found like their exchanges a couple times. I was like, wait, do they know who each other is?
Yeah,
because it seemed to, and they even repeated certain lines again in that way that in Batman Returns is the reason, you know, Batman and Catwoman figured out who the other was. They actually did that once or twice, but I do think with her saving Bruce Wayne from Poison Ivy, which I thought was a great little moment there, you know, it did seem still like they maybe were pretending, but at least put up the charade of like not quite knowing who the other is. But yeah, their exchanges in both Selina, Bruce, and Batman, Catwoman style, I thought was great. And, you know, their sort of push and pull of like, you feel like what makes them such a fascinating couple is why they could never be a couple. It's because they're just too similar.
Right, exactly. I feel like now we have to shout out, Anne Hathaway in Dark Knight Rises. And do we have to talk about Halle Berry? I feel like we shouldn't. You know, I think we should draw the line there. You know, we've mentioned right. Basically all the cat women. There's of course the young Selina Kyle on Gotham, but she's not actually Catwoman. I think she just has like a headband with cat ears, you know, but, it's a very different, aspect of it, but yeah, it is such an interesting character, and what makes the character, obviously she's interesting on her own, but just sort of the fact that she seems to very often have the upper hand on Batman in terms of, at the very least, being able to get away with him, get away from him when he's not expecting it. You know, there's a, there's a couple of those. And yeah, that's probably the most fun, you know, here. I thought in the book was watching the two of them. Is there a character for you, Garrett, that stands out? Somebody that we haven't talked about yet? Maybe a minor character or someone that I'm just missing at this point.
I really did. I really enjoy Sophia. I really like that she has this return to Gotham. We learned that she has this relationship with Salvatore Moroni, which I just love to say. I love Salvatore Moroni's name. Anytime it gets brought up in a Batman thing, I just love the name Salvatore Moroni. It's just the best.
Yeah, it's almost like you have to do it in sort of like the caricature of like Salvatore Moroni. You know, you have to put your fingers up like that. You have to say it like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Geekscape does not approve of the mockery of Italian.
You're right. No, the that's right.
Putting
if
there.
If you want mockery of Italian Americans, go to Tukey Soup. But what were you going to say, Garrett?
Yeah, I really like that it is, you know, she returns. You kind of get the sense that she was going off and doing her own thing, but the crumbling of her family kind of brings her back. She wants to be at her father's side. And I think one of the kind of saddest moments in the whole book is when on Father's Day, at the very end of that issue, she gives him a card, like, and she says, "Happy Father's Day, Papa." And he just says, "I appreciate the gesture." And he just kind of walks off. And then we see that, you know, that Selina is obviously out there watching and she's not getting to experience that.
That's one of those scenes that would make Harry Chapin cry and just throw his hands up and like, I can't even. I mean, come on. Sorry, what were you saying, Gary?
No. Yeah, I really like Sophia. I was sad that she, you know, she didn't make it out of this story. Spoilers, but not related to Holiday, but but it was a non-holiday death, I should say. But I really did enjoy her injection to the story.
Let's talk about, you know, some of the deaths, and it happens in a very stylized way. And this is the Thanksgiving one that Eric had highlighted. And, you know, they're often black and white. I think they're always black and white, you know, and it's sort of a very stylized
with like a splash of color
in this case, the cornucopia, the Horn O' Plenty, as it were, which I believe was Eric's nickname in college, Horn O' Plenty. But you have, and I guess, I don't know, it's a choice, and I feel like we've seen it before, the switching to black and white. I guess it makes it, you know, it makes it, it calls attention to it, but it makes it less gory to look at, I guess, because ultimately, despite what any of us man children might say, comic books are a medium for children. This story is certainly not one. I'm not going to go toss this on my 8-year-old's bed and be like, have at it, you know, but maybe when he's 12, I don't know. But actually, in the middle of that thought, Eric, do you feel like either of your kids would appreciate this? Is it a little bit beyond them? And tell our audience how old they are for way of comparison.
So that then when my kids get taken away from me, we'll know why. No, but my boys are 12 and 15, and I'd have no qualms with them reading this, actually. I mean, my 12-year-old is, he was supposed to see, as these kids call it, the FNAF, Five Nights at Freddy's. And yeah, they call it the FNAF.
I didn't even realize they called it the FNAF. Okay.
FNAF. And so, yeah, no, I mean, this would be nothing to read this. And I think the, you know, the violence is sort of stylized enough as well that it, you know, it's a little bit gory, but, you know, it's not like The Boys or Generation V where they're just like, you know, you ever want to see what a body looks like when it explodes from someone on the inside expanding quickly? Well, there you go.
I was in middle school the first time I saw, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies and things like that.
Oh,
and
God,
now
course.
kids have stuff like, you know, Walking Dead on television, you know, I mean, it's cable television, but
honestly,
know,
if it keeps them from the real creepy stuff out there, I'll take it. Like, you want to read this and that means you're not surfing on the web. Please. Thank you.
It's a great point. But from sort of the storytelling choice, let's focus on that for a moment, Eric.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
calling attention to it. But also maybe, as I stated, it does make it less gory, but it also makes it sort of more poignant aka more artistic, right?
Yeah, what I think too, my older son, you know, we recently like watched Heat, so I think he's gotten a little bit more into this notion of like a crime saga, and I feel right. like this falls under that category. In fact, he's calling me as we speak.
You know, he's like, great. Can I read Batman Long Halloween?
right.
It's on your Kindle twice for some reason.
Yeah, can I borrow your Blockbuster card? So I think like the epic scope of this though is done in such a way. I think the holidays makes it a little more accessible. You mentioned before something I was going to say that this would be an amazing miniseries. You know, yeah. A limited series on HBO Max. I completely agree. Like, you know, in the way that maybe Justice League, you know, the Snyder version should have been. Like, I think this lends itself perfectly to it. It's really, like, I think it takes advantage of episodic storytelling very smartly. I love that sense of, you know, even though we all read it in the course of, you know, maybe a day or two or a handful of hours, like, I think you could really feel that sense of the passage of time. And, you know, and it was a way of maybe for a younger reader, a way to digest the storytelling more so than if it was written in a way like The Godfather or Godfather 2.
Hmm. Or The Godfather 3. Let's make sure.
You mean the only real hot take, only real Godfather?
Hot take, yeah, that is. But I think that the, you know, the artistry, you know, it is one of the things about comic books that, you know, it has over some of these other mediums, you know, sort of some of the images, like, you know, what we're looking at on the screen right now. What did you think about that, Garrett, as you were reading it?
To put on my film school hat from what I learned in color theory, what I like to look at it as is black and white because they're kind of presenting it in a, you know, this is a very black and white world. Is this a bad deed? Is this a good deed? You know, there's no, there, and then there are shades of gray, even in the coloring to kind of like, you know, we're bad people are dying, but is that, you mean, these are guys that rough up people, they kill people for money. And I think it's presenting that kind of idea that this is a black and white world. This is a black and white crime that's happening. Some people see it as good. Some people see it as bad. That's how I just even sitting here right now thinking about it. That's how I kind of view these dips to black, white, gray, and then obviously whatever kind of color is related to either the crime or the holiday that's going on.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the visual representation throughout, you know, yes, and the individual issues, you know, the February issue, it's pink and it has a heart. The March, it's green for St. Patrick's Day, you know, and it's all very well reflected. And I think that, you know, there obviously was some great care put into the way it was presented. And, you know, it's, yeah. So if, I'm very intrigued to see how the, I guess it was direct to DVD market, but I'm pretty sure it's probably streaming at this point, but I would be very interested in seeing it. I believe it's a two-part movie because it is so long, but, I would be very interested in checking that out. What are our, sort of final thoughts, takeaway here? Our Jerry Springer final thought for the moment, Eric, we've talked a little bit about the legacy of this book, sort of the way we, you know, each connected with it. And, you know, I mean, I think it really does capture the feel of when Batman works, it's stories that are told in this way. That's at least my opinion. What are you thinking, you know, as we summarize this, Eric?
Yeah, I think it's a good reminder of why Batman, more than any superhero character, is the one that seems to constantly get rebooted, rewritten, redone, reimagined. Because you realize, like, the world they've created with Gotham, with, you know, people on both sides of the law, like from the police to the gangsters to the more colorful villains, it's such a broad spectrum. Even like Solomon Grundy, who, you know, that's a character who usually, you know, not too much character depth to a Solomon Grundy, but then even the way they used him here, where like Bruce calls him like a lost soul, and then delivered him like a panel I really was floored by. He delivered him a Thanksgiving meal,
Yeah.
And that sounds cheesy until you look at that moment in the comic book and you realize it's not. And I think that's the thing this comic does well. Like it, yeah, Joker shows up, Scarecrow shows up, but they show up in a way where it didn't feel like fan service. It felt like, yeah, inevitably, if you hang out in Gotham for 13 months, you are going to come across these various characters. But I think what's so strong in that storytelling is it didn't get in the way of really this wonderful mystery that was at the center of it. One that it sounds like it, none of us really guessed who the killers actually were. And, you know, I would have been interested to see what it was like to read this one issue at a time. I'm glad I didn't have to because, yeah, I tore through this. Like this was, I think all the books we've read in this book club, this is one I definitely, I think I read the fastest just in terms of like, I didn't want to stop reading it.
Yeah. And I think George Perez Wonder Woman was the slowest just because it was so dense. I thought the artwork was beautiful, but I think Chris Claremont would go through those pages and say, probably too many words on it. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
And I remember the tone of that one. It got really weirdly dark at times too. This one, somehow I think it managed to find a really interesting tone that permeated all 13 issues. It didn't feel, you know, like we've had this issue with some of the MCU shows we've watched recently where every episode is like, wait, is this the same show? But this one here, it all felt very much like a very singular vision all throughout.
Right. And I think when you have two creators who are assigned to a project, you're able to have them spend, you know, possibly even more than a year on it. Sure. But, you know, when, you know, some of the best arcs that are told, you know, in regular issues of a monthly book, a lot of times, you know, you have fill-in artists and there's some great stories that just the inconsistency of the artwork of more recently things I've read from Marvel, it's just so disappointing. There are times where you'll like click on to the next issue or flip it open, however you're reading it, and you go, oh my God, who drew this? You know, this is not the issue at all in this, but there are things that I've read where I'm like, oh man, I really wish they had the same creators for that. Same question for you, Garrett, as you kind of look back on this, you know, looking at it again now and having read it a year ago, do you feel like for you personally, the enduring legacy is of Batman the Long Halloween?
I think it's one of those, you know, seminal books that you're always told about, that, you know, sometimes you maybe have you're kind of worried to read it to see if it lives up to the legacy that's been built from it. You know, you hear that so many things pull from it and you're kind of worried, like, am I going to read this and it not really connect for me? But for myself, I think it is one of those ones. It's like a Watchmen where you read it and you're like, there's a reason why it is spoken of so highly. It's this lovely epic. Like it truly is an epic told over the span of a year that is just about a crime family falling, but a new breed of crime rising. It's about three men who have kind of varying degrees of justice and what the line is. And it's just this beautiful tale that weaves in all these different things, things of like family and living up to legacy and what legacy is, and do the sins of the father impact the, you know, the children, and what it, you know, just all these things. And I just love how it all coalesces. There's also there is a quasi sequel. I think it is treated as a sequel. Loeb and Sale both return for it. It's called Batman Dark Victory. It takes place after this, and it's the origin of this universe is Robin. It retells the tale of Dick Grayson. That's the book I very much I've tried to seek out. I will say, if you're going to read this book for the first time, or Dark Victory, or something I read it like I mentioned, like Batman Hush, I think this is a case where you maybe want to do your due diligence and do some research into one of the creators. I would say Jeff Loeb. You know, there's been some things in recent years that sometimes you have to figure out if you can separate the artist from the art. I think that whether you're going to pick up this book, Dark Victory, whatever, I think you should do that due diligence. But just looking at the art, this book is incredible. I very much hits that sweet spot of what I look for in a Batman story.
And I'll second, by the way, Hush. I really enjoyed
that one. That's actually one of these I would like to do somewhere down the road. We can't, you know, I think Batman's about once a year, but I would like to get to that. And the artwork is one of the reasons why I do something I usually never do on streams that I do and pop myself out because I want to be able to, you know, show off the artwork. It's a lot easier to get rid of Eric, you know, and show it off. But I do like to show it. Anyway, it was a wonderful read and a great chat with all of you. You know, the next installment of the Geekscape Book Club, I believe, will end up being in early December. And I am thinking of doing something holiday themed, and that would be Tom King's Vision, which there are elements to this, which was very well represented in WandaVision, but just the first few episodes. So that is something that, and look, I actually took this out of the library, the Burbank Library, and look at that. So Garrett's got it right there. You can keep holding those up. Yeah, see, look, he's got it right there. So perfect. That's
look what I got.
Not even planned.
Do you have Power Pack number one?
Yeah,
I of course also have Power Pack number one.
Yeah.
Signed by Louise Simonson. But
mine is too. Oh, you got to be kidding me! Yeah.
Well, all right.
Wow! Right. It's amazing. So either of us got married.
So that flex backfired, didn't it?
No. You goodness. Just flexed us deeper into our own geekdom.
Should I lie and say it's also signed by artist June Brigman? It's not, but if she were ever doing a signing, I'd have her sign that in Uncanny X-Men 204. But that being a big nerd flex, that'll be our next installment. And I was very excited that this was on hand at the library. So this is going to be one of those instances where I read the book way before we actually do the show. So follow us on social media to get the exact date on that when we'll be streaming the conversation live. You know, Eric has had an idea that maybe in a future episode, we'll just put aside some time. Maybe we'll talk about the animated version along Halloween. Have you ever seen that, Garrett?
I have. Yes.
Okay. Is it worth our watching and just spending a few minutes on, or is it gonna
to talk around it? Strike solidarity wise, I will say yes, and I think it would be very interesting to do it. It's one of those adaptations where you hope that changes are made, and obviously some changes are made from medium to medium, but it's also fun to watch if you're someone who already knows the mystery. I would say the mystery itself is different.
Yeah, I actually thought that you know, the Killing Joke animated movie that came out a few years ago, people there was a pretty tremendous negative backlash, but in general, I thought the parts that were adapted from the story, I thought they did a great job with. Garrett might feel differently. No, I think he just got disconnected. When he comes back, yeah, there he goes.
Sorry, like, my God, don't talk about it. It is weird. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. I think it even changed your audio source, but that's right. We're wrapping up. In terms of reading, we did a special episode of Marvel Movie Talk right here on Geekscape earlier in the week. We do weekly Friday episodes talking about Loki, but we did a special where we talked to Andrew DeMann, who runs the Claremont Run Twitter page. It's actually a research project that he got a grant for in Canada. And the book, The Claremont Run, Subverting Gender in the X-Men, we did a special on that. And Eric, you were there. I am already thinking like I could have done five parts on that, you know, about it.
It's really in-depth research, but the book's actually also, you know, I think as I was, you know, per our last interview with him, and, you know, it's also like very accessible. Like you don't just read this and feel like you're looking at graphs and feel like you're in like, I don't know, an economics course or something. Like it actually was done really smartly. And it made, as I was telling you guys last time, it made me actually rethink like that when I was reading comic and looking how characters were dressed. I found myself focusing on that even with this read. So
there's a lot of there's a section that focuses on torn clothing. You can find that here on the Geekscape YouTube channel, and it'll be up on the Marvel Movie Talk audio feed before too long.
just like our show, which we talk Loki every Friday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. So please join us for that. As we're recording this, we have two more episodes of Loki, and we're looking forward to talking about that. And of course, you can find me Twitter, Instagram at Christian DMZ, my personal podcast, The Blackcast, BLADTCAST. And who are these broadcasters? Tuesday afternoons on the Who Are These Podcasts YouTube channel. Lots of promotion. But Eric Connor, where can you be found?
You can find me at Count Eric Connor over at Instagram and over at the X. I hang out there. You're welcome to say hello. Yes, the big X. And Garrett, where can we find you?
That's what I was going to ask. Thank you for beating me to the punch. Yeah.
Fully, I care about funny. Garrett.
Thank you. Garfield. So you can find me on at not just a guy prod. That is my quote unquote production entity. That is where my podcast, Not Just A Guy, is putting out new episodes. That's on Instagram, X, and TikTok. And this Halloween, this Tuesday, we have a new episode with Sad Girl Cinemas, Caitlin Scardino and Balinese. They are two filmmakers. They run their own production company. They are great gals. Had a great talk with them. Following week, November 7th, I have Ken Knapsack of the Knapsack Network Force Center, a long-running broadcaster and podcaster, have him on. So some very fun episodes are coming up in the next 2 weeks.
Well, that sounds great. And everybody, make sure they follow Garrett so that they can be on top of everything. And we'll be back next time talking Vision. As always, as long as they keep writing, we'll keep reading them, and we'll see you guys next time. See you men, women, children, and everyone next time. I don't want to just say Halloween. See you guys. I was talking to these two guys, but I also want to see all of you next time.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.